This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. As always, you're listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. I, of course, am Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, ready to roll for the next hour with a trainer who has learned his craft from a New Jersey legend. That's trainer John Forbes. And if you miss any portion of this interview in the first half of the show, don't worry. We will replay the entire interview in the second half of today's program. Keep in mind that in the years that my guest tonight spent working with and learning from John, he had the chance to be around such standout graded stakes horses as two-time Oceanport Handicap winner Boyce and Delaware Handicap winner Amarillo. Get Serious, who recorded 5 graded stakes wins, including 3 in the Red Bank Stakes, and of course the talented Tell of the Cat, who won the King's Bishop at Saratoga in 1997. But this past weekend was pretty good for the guest on today's show. He saddled on his own, by the way, his 5-year-old New Jersey bred Golden Brown prior to a victory in Monmouth's Irish War Cry Handicap. And he is trainer Pat McBurney, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Pat, welcome to the show, and congrats on that big win this weekend.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Boy, that's a good horse, isn't it?
Yeah, he's been a lot of fun to be around. He was a bit of a handful as a 3-year-old, and we went ahead and gelded him, and he's calmed down and turned into heck of a racehorse for us. So
it's amazing the difference that can make with a racehorse. We hear that a lot, and people that are listening that might not be in tune with the way that trainers make those decisions. You look at a horse and you say, okay, this horse has a lot of value. We don't really want to make that move and geld him because it takes being a stallion out of play. How difficult, Pat, can it be to make that call?
It is very difficult, and him being one of the partnership horses, we always like to buy, the colts or the fillies, and his pedigree probably being an awfully wild wasn't super strong, but you always like to let him develop and see what kind of horses they're going to be, and it became apparent in his 3-year-old year, he was having a good year, but just against Jersey breds, but was just would just fall apart in the paddock before a race where he would be dripping wet and like be beating me and the jockey to death trying to get him up on him and everything. So the decision was made at that point he'd be a better racehorse as a gelding. So that's when we did it with him.
Well, he's now won 8 of 22 lifetime starts. He's earned, just over $500,000 in his career. And, that has to be rewarding for you, too. You have this New Jersey bred. You know he has talent. You make that call. It turns out to be the right call. And now here he is with more than $500,000 in earnings.
Yeah, he's been steady and solid every year. He'll do turf or dirt. He does prefer a mile or further. But when we had picked him, when he made the short list at the Fasig Tipton October sale, didn't even realize he was a New Jersey bred until one of the other members of the team pointed out, oh, we come to Kentucky to buy a New Jersey bred. So kind of a fun story with him for sure.
Yeah, and it's been a fun ride. He is a grade 3 winner, too. Let's not overlook that. He took you to grade 3 success with that win in the Kent Stakes back in 2018 at Delaware. That had to be pretty special, too.
Yeah, that was a fantastic day. Some of the owners were down at Delaware that day, and yes, to get a graded win with him was fantastic. So,
when you have a horse of this caliber, Pat, and I know you've been around a lot of good horses in your career, even when you were working with John, and we'll talk more about that as we move throughout the half hour here this morning, but You take a look at a horse like this who is so good, who has so much talent, has had so much success. He hadn't won since August of last year. He had kind of been struggling to get back to the winner's circle, and it finally happens in the Irish War Cry this weekend. What's that mean for a trainer?
I mean, just for the owners to have faith in the horse and myself, you know, to let us have the program and the layout for the New Jersey season. Most of, if not all my clients, you know, we love racing at Monmouth Park in the summertime. And especially this year with COVID, not knowing what our situation was going to be and having everything pushed back for 45, 60 days, I mean, just their faith in sticking with the program, is, you know, and for him to do that really paid off for us. And look forward to a big second half of the year for the whole stable, really. So,
well, Pat, let's go back to the beginning, because this show, we'll talk about your top horses, but this show is as much about your horses as it is about you. So take me back to the beginning. Where did Pat McBurney first fall in love with horse racing?
I guess had moved from, was born in Philadelphia, and we moved from Pennsylvania down to Maryland, and a fellow who ended up being a fellow trainer himself was my best friend in Bowie, Maryland, and his father would take us out to the racetrack on Saturday afternoons at Bowie Racecourse, and, you know, we just kind of fell in love with horse racing, mainly trying to hit the last race trifecta at that time, but, and after high school, we'd go catch the last couple of races over at Bowie, and from there, turned into weekend jobs and summer jobs, and just was fortunate enough to meet John Forbes, who had a string of Big John Tamaro's horses at the time, and was a force in Maryland racing. So I got to be surrounded by, you know, when you're around 40 plus horses every day, you get to learn a lot more than if you're around 5 or 10 horse stable. So, yeah, just went on from being a hot walker to groom to foreman and worked our way up. So a lot of fun and enjoy it to this day. So,
you know, so many people, myself included, started like yourself, Pat, going to the races, betting horses, trying to hit that trifecta in the last race and the late, you know, double or whatever it is. And eventually found their way into working in the sport. When did you know that you wanted to go from just being a fan to getting involved in the sport somehow?
Just almost ever since starting out walking horses in the morning, just loved being around the racehorses. And then, like you said, the puzzle of the handicapping game on top of it. I mean, just the two things, it was just so much excitement, and the racehorses themselves are fantastic to be around. And, you know, like just watching a horse, you can tell when they start to feel good or acting good or training good. And everything you learn about the game, whether a horse is bumped leaving the starting gate, just, you know, that adds to the puzzle of the afternoon racing. So, yeah, it's just the whole everything from morning to the last race of the day is a lot of fun in thoroughbred horse racing. So,
was there ever a point in the early part of your journey, Pat, when you were thinking about getting started, you started walking hots, that you said, boy, I don't know, maybe there is something else out there, maybe I do want to do something outside of horse racing? Was there ever that moment for you?
There really wasn't. It was probably after my junior year of high school, and I'd been on the racetrack a year, where I thought that being a veterinarian would have been a wonderful path to work on horses in that venue, but unfortunately had let my grade slip that year, and like every college applied to, it did not look like that would pan out. So yeah, just stuck with the racehorse end of it. So, and yeah, no regrets whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's worked out really, really well for you. You're sitting here right now with almost 300 career victories as a trainer, which I know has to mean a lot to you. More than $10 million in career earnings, according to what Equibase is showing. And that's a big deal, and a multiple greatest stakes winning trainer. Talk about some of the people, Pat, and the things you learned from them along the way that helped you get to this point.
I mean, if you go back to the very beginning at Bowie Racetrack and being a hot walker and then a groom and a couple other young guys like myself, Steve Brown and James Pauly, you know, we would literally be around the barn all day. And to his credit, Dr. Jimmy Stewart, a big veterinarian in Maryland, would save our barn till last. And more times than not, John Forbes was there himself. If we had a horse to look at But Dr. Stewart would literally spend hours with us showing us what he was seeing and what should be addressed on a thoroughbred racehorse, you know, whether it was a problem, whether it wasn't a problem, just the overall health of horses. So just learning everything you can. And it really comes down to, I mean, if you can get your horse good and healthy, take care of him physically, he's going to go out there and perform for you. And it's just those early years of doing that. And then following it up in Florida with Dr. Ben Franklin, did the same for John and I with hind end problems and everything, because they were prevalent with the Calder tartan surface way back then. I mean, just the overall learning and, you know, just try, like each horse trying to figure them out and what to get them healthy makes them happy, and then they'll go over there and perform for you. So, yeah.
Yeah, and John Forbes, I mentioned at the introduction that he was a New Jersey legend. There's no doubt about it. He trained before his retirement more than 2,100 winners. What made John Forbes such a good trainer?
I think that, one, I guess, I mean, his father and mother both were trainers, you know, so he was from a long line of Maryland horsemen. And then it seemed like getting involved with John Tamaro really got him to be around a large stable of horses. And I think that's it, the exposure to a large stable of horses. And John Forbes would say about Big John, he was more horse than he was human. I mean, he would figure a horse out, and yeah, it's just amazing. So I was lucky to be around, like I said, large stables of horses with two horsemen that, you know, like their main focus was what to make this horse as happy and healthy as he can be. And taking it from there, then they go out and perform on the racetrack for us. So
what was your first year with John?
It had to be back around 1972 or so, 1973 in Bowie, Maryland. So
yeah, boy, what a ride that was, and so many great stakes winners that came through that barn, and you had the privilege to be around so many of them. Who are some of the horses that, when you think back on that time, Pat, that you're always going to remember?
I mean, there was one horse who was a particular favorite of mine, and he was not a superstar by any means, but he was just a beautiful chestnut colt named LeGrand Charles. And if you can imagine, you hear the stories of horses having horns. He had the two lumps on his head like he had horns, and he was just a nice three-year-old that would run two turns. But from there, you go to, speaking about horses being gelded, Get Serious, as a three-year-old came out and was very fast. But towards the end of his three-year-old season, he literally would take 30 to 40 minutes to get to the paddock. And at the end of his three-year-old year, the decision was made to geld him. Well, his first race as a four-year-old at Monmouth Park, he literally drugged the groom to the paddock, took to the turf course, and went on to be the first over $1 million owner for John Forbes. So, and won multiple graded stake races and is in the Monmouth Park Hall of Fame. So, he was a lot of fun. The biggest name horse that I got to be around with John was obviously Tail the Cat. And in that same partnership, there were a couple fillies, Amarillo, who won the Delaware Handicap. I mean, just stake horse after stake horse. So it was fun being involved in the partnership. And when John retired, a lot of the partners now are still with me, and we have the partnerships going on. So you get to be around some nice pedigreed young horses. And the plan is, if they show they have talent at three and four, we keep them. If not, then they go to the claiming races or retired, depending on their level of ability. But, yeah, it's just a wonderful way to keep young horses coming in the barn every year. So,
you know, when I was looking back through all of the greatest stakes winners that came through John's operation, and, of course, as I mentioned, you had a big hand in that. There was one name. I wasn't familiar with the name, so I went back and looked up the horse, but I thought the name was cool. The name of the horse is Peanut Butter On It. Tell me about that horse.
Peanut Butter On It was a chestnut gelding that we had claimed for a client, I think for $25,000, and he also went on to win many stakes. And, yeah, he was just a big, neat gelding and couldn't have been more fun to be around. And, yeah, he was very very precocious at Monmouth Park, so he was a lot of fun too, yeah.
Did it help when you ended up taking over after John retired? And I guess that's the way it went down, right? You ended up taking over his operation pretty much and then moving on from there. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, okay. When you ended up taking over the operation, does it help you now, having been around so many good horses? Does that help a trainer when they finally take over and start doing it on their own?
Yeah, I think to be around nice horses, but also us being the claimant operation and, you know, knowing, you know, what it takes to keep a horse sound and feeling good. Yeah, like I said, the fact that I was always around 40 or more horse stables, and at one time John had three strings of horses, I was in charge of one, you know, kind of, and back then it was unheard of to have that many horses. Now there's trainers that have probably two or three times as many horses as we had back then. But yeah, just to see the numbers and to be around a 40-horse stable just shows you so much. So, yeah.
Talking with trainer Pat McBurney here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Of course, that big win this past weekend with Golden Brown in the Irish War Cry Handicap at Monmouth, that's just one of many big moments he's been part of in his career. And talking about John Forbes, who he worked with for a long time, you know, there's horsemen game and there are trainers in this game. And I've done this show long enough now, Pat, to realize that there's a difference between the two. There are true horsemen. And I think when you look at a guy like John Forbes, you look at him as a horseman, right? You don't look at him as strictly just a trainer.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, the way he was raised with the family and everything, and the work ethic of John Tamaro's stable, whether it was John Forbes, John's own son, John Tamaro the fourth, I believe. And yeah, I mean, just the whole family was into horse racing. So.
And you mentioned the claiming game and obviously a claiming operation and keeping horses sound. And how do you do that? Take me inside that. That's a whole different approach to training. Take me inside the claiming game and your approach and your philosophy to being successful in that arena.
I mean, there's so many tools available nowadays that maybe we didn't have, but one of the main things, and going back to John Tamaro, was like marking the program. He would have John Forbes and his son, John Tamaro, and his other son, Mike Tamaro. I mean, their job would be to stand at the paddock all day and just mark the legs of every horse and spot potential claims. And then you look at the racing form. And there were a lot more levels back then, a lot more horse racing back then. But Big John's philosophy was, you know, you can only improve a racehorse if you can train them. If you claim a sore horse, you can't improve them because you can't take the training. And then, I mean, back then, Big John Tamaro would claim horses and they'd go on to win stake races. And the whole philosophy was, you know, if we had a bad mark on a horse, we didn't like how a horse moved, you know, win, lose, or draw, there were no qualms about it. You just would move on to the next one, because he'd also say, you know, if you don't spend the money, you can't lose the money. He said, if you're going to claim a horse, you claim it like that's your money you're spending. So I would prefer not to claim a horse that I hadn't seen. But we also have horses coming from all over the racetrack. So literally when a horse is in a claiming race, you have 4 or 5 minutes to make a decision, watching them walk into the paddock before. At Monmouth Park, it's 10 minutes. Once the clock goes to 10 minutes, you can't drop a claim slip. Some tracks it's 12, some tracks it's 15. So you literally have 3 to 5 minutes to make that decision on spending anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000 on a horse. So it helps if you had seen that individual before. And like I said, nowadays we go back, we watch the replays, you see if a horse changes leads, how a horse travels in a race, if you like that or not. So yeah, it's just, I mean, the technology nowadays makes it easier. And then you also have thoroughgraph numbers, Ragusan numbers, buyer numbers. I mean, you kind of know the level of competition, which maybe back in the day you could really improve a horse because all this information wasn't available. But it's still a chess game. Like, no trainer wants to lose a good horse, and no trainer wants to claim a horse that's too slow. So,
yeah, and, you know, you mentioned all the information that's out there now and the difference in the approach to claiming horses now as opposed to back before, you know, we had replays and all that kind of stuff. And I guess, Pat, it's similar to what we hear about with handicappers, where there's so much information out there. Everybody has speed figures. Everybody has these accessible numbers that used to be reserved for just the folks that would really pay attention. And you kind of almost bring everybody onto a more level playing field. Does it, in some respects, because there is so much information out there, does it make the claiming game maybe even a little more, I don't know if difficult's the right word, or more competitive?
Yeah, I would think probably more competitive, like you said, Mike, because you know, we all can access the same information.
Yeah.
I mean, there's trainers that strictly rely on, they'll just drop a slip without looking at a horse, just on form and numbers, which, you know, you still need the individual. Like, I mean, you don't want a little scrawny three-year-old, because now this time of year, it's all the races are three and up. So, yeah, the individual has, you know, just because a horse ran a fast race once or twice, you need to think, will that horse develop and continue to do that? Like, what the horse does today when I claim it really doesn't matter to me. It's, do I get the horse back to the barn? Is the horse sound? And can I, you know, get the horse into a spot? As long as the horse is sound and I can get him healthy and happy and training how we want, then the horse will go out there and perform for you. So,
what do you consider to be the greatest claim you've ever made?
I mean, you mentioned Peanut Butter On It. Way back when, we had a horse make a decision, also won the Oceanport. This is all with John Forbes. It seemed like you could probably claim horses easier back then. Like I said, a lot of people weren't aware that, you know, if you claimed a horse for $15,000 to $20,000, that was a lot of money back in the 80s and early 90s. And a solid claiming horse could go through their allowance conditions and maybe even step up into the little stake races at that time and perform well. Nowadays, most recently, I mean, there's been horses that, you know, we have a horse named Tree Shaker who we took very cheap and we just thought he would take to the turf. And he's been a lot of fun over the last couple of years. He's won four or five races, you know, in the last two or three years, and we turn him out every year and just keep him strictly on turf now. But, yeah, it's just little successes like that that, you know, you turn a horse around or you get your owner in the winner's circle. And that's the fun of the claiming game compared to whether you breed them or the yearlings we buy, because, like, a yearling, you almost have to give them their whole two-year-old year, where a claiming horse, in two or three weeks, you're back in action. So, yeah, it depends on what the client's looking for. And, yeah. So.
Pat McBurney with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Tell me about a horse by the name of Just Call Kenny. I know he has to hold a special place in your heart.
Kenny was fantastic. We had bought him as a yearling, and he turned out on January 1st of his three-year-old year, he won a stake race at Gulfstream Park only because we couldn't get an allowance race to go for him going six furlongs. And he went on to be just one heck of a fun racehorse. He had his setbacks and some minor injuries along the way, but always performed very well and ran super hard for us. So,
yeah, when did you first get a sense that he was going to be a special horse?
I mean, almost from day one. Terry Gabriel, who goes to the sales with us and breaks the yearlings in Folsom, Louisiana, thought that he was special. And, I mean, he was, to this, anyone that saw him, and he, like, would walk in a paddock, and he just was such a gorgeous-looking racehorse. He caught everyone's eye, and he, from his very first breeze and everything, he was just like, you hear the expression, a man among boys. When he was a two-year-old, he won his first start at Monmouth Park, and then, like I said, had a very good three-year-old year and then some setbacks. But, yeah, just always a special, special horse and always tried very hard. So,
yeah, and that big grade three win in the Island Stakes back in 2017, a special moment for you and for the team, I know, as the Island, one of the major races on the calendar every year at Monmouth Park in New Jersey. Tell me about, as I was getting ready for the show, Pat, and I made it a point, we only have a few minutes left, but I made it a point to write a note that I had to ask you about this. Tell me about Bluegrass Mini Golf Course.
So Bluegrass Mini Golf was a vision John Forbes had at the, up at the top of the, past the quarter pole and outside the track at Monmouth Park. There used to be, it's kind of a area where they would store extra equipment and everything, and John just thought to add a miniature golf course up there would be fantastic. And why he got the idea, like, on after work and before feed time, I would go back in that area and there was enough room where you could chip golf balls, and I was a terrible golfer, which I still am to this day, but would go out there and practice. And he said, oh, this will be a good place for a little miniature golf course. And He researched it and had the company. It has two 18-hole courses. They've actually hosted the Masters twice now for the miniature golf. And, yeah, it's an international event, but it's just a gorgeous, fun place. And now there's the Blue Grotto restaurant right beside there with the beer garden underneath. So, family can spend a day there and have burgers or pizzas and whatever afterwards. So, yeah, it's just a fun area right across from the racetrack. And Dad can actually, from the beer garden, make it better, too, if he wishes. So, yeah, it works out very nice.
Yeah, fantastic. There's actually a website. You can go to the Bluegrass Mini Golf Course website. And I was on there, and I was looking at some of the holes, and I had no idea that there were majors in mini golf and that there were actually professional mini golf players. I didn't even know it existed.
Neither did I until a couple of years ago. So, yep.
Yeah, the other cool thing I read in the story was about the lawn jockey that's positioned on the 18th hole, the home hole. Do you remember what I'm talking about there with the lawn jockey and the colors of the lawn jockey?
I know that there's two of them up there. One has Dennis Drazen's silks and the other has the ABL silks.
Yep.
But also each of the holes are named after famous racehorses up there too. So that's the plaques are there and you can read about the racehorses. It's very interesting.
Pretty cool. I bet you never thought you'd be the inspiration for a mini golf course, huh?
No, how about that with my bad golf game?
Yeah, pretty cool. Trainer Pat McBurney here on Trainer Talk. We have less than 2 minutes, Pat, so I always like to end by asking a trainer to tell us something about them maybe we haven't touched on yet, or a hobby that you might get into outside of horse racing, any other interest that you have away from the racetrack. What might it be?
I mean, I enjoy freshwater fishing and golf, like I just mentioned. Had read where, getting a little older, so you want to try to keep your mind sharp. And honestly, I haven't been practicing the last year and a half, but I had taken up the violin, and I think I'll get back into that to keep my fingers nimble and everything like that. So,
wow, good for you. Multi-talented Pat McBurney here on the Horse Racing Radio Network and Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Pat, listen, it's been enjoyable to hear your story and to catch up with you for a little bit. All the best moving forward, and keep it rolling, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. You take care.
All right, you too. Pat McBurney here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Yeah, some cool stuff there, huh? Interesting. That story about the golf course, I had to bring that up at some point to him, because how many people can say that they were the inspiration for any kind of golf course, mini golf or otherwise? But Pat McBurney, my thanks to him. It's Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you can't lose.
Hello, I'm Michael Blowen, founder of Old Friends Thoroughbred Retirement Farm. One of our highest priorities for these living legends is safety. That's why the fence we trust most at Old Friends is the V-Mesh Keepsake from Red Brand. Keepsake features a V-Mesh weave to prevent hooves from getting caught, and the mesh design flexes on impact. Learn more about the quality, safety, and long-lasting value of Keepsake V-Mesh Horse Fence by visiting redbrand.com.